Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from quadriplegic pilot Carrie Wright. So, since our prior interview, how have things been going in terms of your disability's flight?
Oh, it's been going good. I've been practicing quite a bit on a simulator in the off season. So when the spring came along last year, I was pretty good at finding the lift. And I had several flights that were about 3 hours long. And that's about my limit because I start to get a little bit tired and a little bit thirsty by then.
So for those who may have missed your prior story, can you give me sort of an overview of your connection to accessible flight?
Well, I followed the Freedom's Wings program, which is very much out in Ontario there. I'm in Alberta, and I'm a quadriplegic. And so what they have done is they've helped me see that it's possible. And we've got a lift out here at the Edmonton Soaring Club that lifts me into the glider. And then once I'm in, an instructor comes with me, and a special cuff allows me to grab the joystick. And I can do all the flying except for the initial toe at the beginning, which requires a little bit of strength.
So in terms of your flight, have there been any challenges in learning the process and gaining overall control?
The only challenges I have found is coming up with a firm way to grab the joystick. Because I'm a quadriplegic, my fingers don't work, and my arms only work partially. So the only thing was to safely get a hold of the joystick, because I wouldn't want to be letting go of the controls as we're landing or something like that, that would require my backup pilot to grab the controls quickly.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time with Freedom's Wings and other accessible flight, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Oh, there's the first success moment was, it's sort of a little informal thing that when you, all the people glide for the day, they talk about who got the longest flight and the highest and stuff like that. And there have been a few times where I have had the longest flight of the day. And so for me, it was a personal success because I'm relatively a low-time pilot compared to some of the other people at the club. There's some very good pilots out there that fly gliders.
So how did you become involved with Freedom's Wings?
I read about it in a magazine. And then I initially called the Calgary Flight Club because at QNIM because they were a member of Freedom's Wings at the time. And so when I initially called them, I explained that I hadn't heard of a quadriplegic flying yet, but I had heard of paraplegics flying. And would they be available or would they consider giving me a chance to see if we could come up with a way that I could fly? And their immediate response was, absolutely, get down here and we'll figure it out.
So, you wrote a very compelling letter on the subject of flying. So, that being so, If you could send any message to the community about the need for accessibility in flight, what would you say?
I would say that it is a complete life-changing experience to be able to get into an aircraft and get in the air and away from the restraints of a wheelchair. Like, it's total freedom to be in an aircraft and guiding it around. And I would say it is so important for the psyche of the person with the disability. You come down a completely changed person, and even though you may not get in the air for a long time afterwards, the memory never fades, and the grin from your face just stays and stays every time you think about it.
So what are the next steps for you in your flights?
I'm starting to go longer and longer in the air, and what we're doing now is we're extending the flights out farther and farther. And, of course, you know, there's quite an issue if you don't make it home in a glider and one of the people inside it is a quadriplegic. So we're just being very careful that I can either make it home with the glider or we can make it to another airport where the tow plane can drop in and get us going again.
Can you give me an overview of some of the specific modifications that made it possible for you to fly?
Some of the gliders have the rudder pedals that are controlled to a joystick, and that allows you to control them with your left hand by pushing forward and back on a joystick. And other than that, the only modifications we did was the cuff that attaches to my arm. So I can actually jump from glider to glider, and you don't really need to run the rudder pedals all the time. So even in gliders without the adapted rudder pedals, I have no trouble flying them as long as I have my cuff along in my hand.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
No problem. I sure will. Thank you.
Kerry went on to mention that the same principle that allows him to operate the glider with a cuff also allows him to use a zero-turn lawnmower. Just a remarkable thing. Person with a disability exceeding yet another perceived barrier in society and saying, I can do this. I believe that I can, and I'm going to find a way. In this next segment of our show, we'll hear from Richard Macias from the 10-4 Teddy Bear Wheelchair Foundation. So tell me a little bit about the foundation.
Okay, back in 2006, Mary passed away from colon cancer. And at that time, I wanted to set up a foundation in her memory. And in Red Sylvain or Boxcar Willie's song, 10-4 Teddy Bear, would come in appropriate because it's truckers befriended a little boy in a wheelchair, and they all gave him a ride. And I was working for three different transport companies during that time doing paperwork, going, getting them across the U.S. border. And I figured I was hoping that the truckers were going to buy teddy bears to sort of help the foundation to buy wheelchairs. But at that time, they hit into hard times, and things didn't go. And I was hoping that since she was a teacher, the teachers would sort of come on board. But there was they had other charities, and it would be individual schools that would be doing it. And sort of that didn't exactly pan out. So I tried calling the different companies that I used to deal with when I was in the industry. But, of course, you know, when you retire, you're not in the loop anymore. And you're not doing business with them. And sort of that sort of also, you know, didn't work out. So the past couple of years, I sort of got discouraged and wasn't soliciting. And I decided, well, this year, it's 10 years that Mary passed away, to start going after the truckers again and see if they would sort of carry a teddy bear in their truck and put the word out that, you know, 10-4 Teddy Bear is a song by Red Sylvain. And also the Boxcar Willie came out with that song a couple of years ago.
So has there been any success moment with the foundation in your time with it?
Well, right now I sort of I was in limbo the past 2 years. I haven't done anything. I was incorporated back in 2007, March 27th. I was registered with the Canadian and the Quebec government, and things haven't been going good so far. There's no, doesn't seem to be any support.
So, if you could send any message to the community about what you're hoping to accomplish.
That's right. I'm trying to get, let's say, any organizations that would like to help out, even the trucking industry, if they would sort of, you know, purchase a box or two and get their truckers to carry these teddy bears in their cabs. I've seen one of the cancer fundraisers that there were a couple of truckers have different teddy bears on their windshields. And I'm hoping that the industry would hear about it and say, hey, come on, let's support this guy. He was in the industry also. We can carry these teddy bears across Canada and, you know, let's do it.
So, how would you hope the community would respond in terms of getting the message out there?
Put the word out on Twitter, their Facebook profiles and everything else, and they can always get back to me by going onto the my website, which is 10-4teddybear.com. The whole story is on there. They can see some interviews that I've had in the past. They can see different things about Mary on there. They can see the different companies who at the beginning came on board and bought a number of boxes, and sort of the teddy bears were donated to the Montreal Children's Hospital, and the kids went wild when they seen these bears. But then it just sort of dried up for a while. Nobody had money to sort of buy, and I sort of got discouraged after a while. And I'm hoping that the community in Ontario would come on board if they can put the word out west and even the eastern Canada. That would be great also. We can get the foundation back on board and moving.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure, thank you.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
As spring draws near, it's important to remember to change the batteries in all smoke and carbon monoxide alarms. In order for these alarms to do their job, they need to have fresh batteries. Old batteries should be replaced once a year. Take time to check the age of your alarms. The Amherstburg Fire Department recommends replacing all smoke and carbon alarms when they are 10 years old or even sooner. In order to survive a fire, you need an early warning sign and a plan for when the alarms do sound. Remember, it's the law to have working smoke alarms on every story of your home and outside any sleeping area. Make your spring cleaning routine include a fire and carbon alarm checkup.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Carrie Wright and Richard Massius. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Mary Ellen Nielsen from Arby. In this segment of our show, we'll be chatting with Ellen Nielsen from Arby. So tell me a little bit about the history of Arby.
Okay, so Arby started about 40 years ago, and it started with our founder, Audrey, and she knew a lady from her church, and the lady's son, the lady's name was Alice, the lady's son was on leave, he was in the services, was on leave, and he was a hit and run twice, one car hit him and another car hit him, and so very difficult, and was in a coma, and they said he couldn't be helped, and so Audrey felt differently and decided to help her friend, and so that was the beginning, really, of the rehabilitation approach that Arby takes, and so they worked with, this was our first client, his name was Mel, and they worked with him, gosh, for a period of a number of years. And the way that he improved was phenomenal. And so that was actually like I said, the beginnings of activity-based rehab. They had him doing, you know, different art things and physical things, and he just did tremendously well. And so that continues to be the basis of our approach today, combining science and compassion, so that people can improve. And it's basically the neuroplasticity of the brain. The brain truly can heal.
So, are there any challenges in this work?
Oh, I would say, Cam, there's many challenges. The biggest challenge is certainly not for our staff, but the big challenge is for the families. A brain injury doesn't just happen to the individual, you can imagine, and we serve the very severe client base, and so it just has a profound impact on the entire family. And so the challenges faced by the family trying to support the individual survivor is tremendous, and it we see it every day, and I'm so impressed by the family.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time with RB, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Yeah, no, I've only been with RB a couple of years. There are people, some of our staff have been here, Cam, about 30 years. But the first time I saw it, it was amazing. We had a young man that was in here, and I think he was about 18 months post-injury. And one day he just started talking. The brain was healing, and so he was able to Skype with his mother, who actually was out your way, out in Ontario, and tell his mom that he loved him. And so that was like a huge moment here at RB, certainly for me, because I'd not seen it before. But these types of things happen quite a bit, and like I said, that was 18 months post-injury.
So how does the community typically respond to the work that you do?
I would say a couple of things, and that's why I'm so happy to be able to speak with you. I think that we quietly, just like our founder, Audrey, we just quietly go about our work. We also get the help of over 100 student volunteers, which I think would interest you because I believe you're a student volunteer station. But we have about 100 student volunteers from the various post-secondary institutions around here, and so they're studying everything from, you know, kinesiology, neuroscience, social work. And so they come and commit their time to our clients. They sign up for a minimum 9-month period to come and work with the client. So in addition to our therapists, the volunteers are helping that client. And, that as a level of community support from very, very busy students is phenomenal. I think more people need to know about this model. A lot of healthcare happens in the hospital, and ours doesn't. We're out in the community. We're in a couple of little old houses. And so healthcare in the community, utilizing the support of the community to build that network around our survivors, I think is just an incredible model. I think the challenge is making people aware of that and making sure that it can continue. And I don't think there's an RB out in Ontario, but to me, they should be across the country.
So if you could send any one message to the community about the need for a program such as yours, what would you say?
I think the message, it would be to the community and to survivors everywhere. And I think the message would be, this is a spot in life any of us could be in, from a car crash or a stroke. So any of us could need an RB someday, and that, at the time that you would need it, that would be probably one of the darkest moments in your life. And so important that there's an RB there, and also to know that you don't need to give up, that there's hope, because brains do heal. So I think that would be, I know that's sort of a dual message, but I think for Brain Awareness Week, that's important for people to know that we're out there, and to know that that if something like this happens to you, and it's so tragic that, life doesn't have to be over, life will be different, but life doesn't have to be over.
So what are the next steps for RB?
I think for us, we just completed our strategic plan about a year ago. And part of it was certainly to raise our profile and to raise awareness. We've been around 40 years, and we raise a tremendous, about half of our budget from donations. So we've got people, including, former volunteers that have gone on to be healthcare professionals and family members that have been impacted by our work. So we've got tremendous supporters on the donation side, but the growth in demand for our services, particularly, I think, with an aging demographic. I think our strokes are getting younger. That's concerning. But the demand in our services, we really do need to raise our profile, both in terms of getting government support and community support, so that we can continue to meet the demand.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Joan Rinker. She'll be giving us an update on alcohol babies. So, what's the latest with alcohol babies?
I cannot remember exactly when we spoke the last time, but we're celebrating our 10th anniversary this year. Alcohol Babies Anonymous was the original name of the organization, and now it's called Alcohol Babies Incorporated. Over the last 10 years, we've centered on a couple of areas that can help people who have prenatal alcohol exposure, and it can also educate the public. One of those areas, it has been the distribution of maternity T-shirts. They say, "I'm having what she's having." And the other has been the distribution of educational material. And we found a good outlet for the educational material at the local churches. We were asked to celebrate FASD Observance Day, which is September 9th each year, and we decided that we could make an impact by putting a insert into church bulletins, which are the little flyers that people get when they walk into church. So for the past 5 years, we have developed a unique bulletin insert that people will read when they're sitting waiting for a church service to start, and it tells what alcohol does to babies before they're born, and it also alerts people to the fact that there are a lot of individuals in our communities who have these defects and are not diagnosed. We've also got materials that are published by the Canadian government. One of them is called The Sensible Guide to a Healthy Pregnancy, and the other one is specifically on the subject of FASD, which is fetal alcohol syndrome, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And we collate these booklets together, and we distribute them through people who are giving prenatal sessions. And we've distributed between the church bulletin inserts and the government publications, we've distributed about 10,000 copies of different kinds of literature over the last couple of years.
So, in your time with the foundation, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
We've had some really nice experiences in sharing this information. My husband and I made the decision to take a presentation to the country of Panama. And we joined a international baby fair that they give for the whole of Central America. It's given in Panama City. And I don't think I have ever seen so many expectant mothers in my life, because they have an attendance at that fair over the course of 2 or 3 days of about 15,000 people. And we had a little stand, and we gave away information, and we raffled off T-shirts and had a PowerPoint presentation going. And I was a featured speaker for one of their mini sessions. So that was quite an exciting time. And other than that, we've had a lot of presentations where people saw the light go on to understand the behavior of people that they were dealing with, and some who were alarmed and alerted to the fact that they needed to change their own habits. So we can't tell exactly how much good we're doing, because We only know that we're saving people from potential harm, but those kinds of experiences do help us to get motivated to keep going.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for proper screenings for fetal alcohol syndrome, what would you say?
There's a lot that can be said on the subject of screening. First of all, I think most children who've been in the care of Children's Aid Society at some time, all of those children should probably be screened, because many times the reason that children end up in care is because of some kind of substance issue on the behalf of their mothers. And so if Children's Aid Society could make more of an effort to screen those children, it would probably help their foster families to understand them better. And early diagnosis is really important for helping children who have prenatal alcohol damage. So that would be one screening device. And the other would be for the physicians, the family physicians themselves, to be more active in looking for this disorder. Many times we've been told that family physicians don't want to tell parents that their children have prenatal alcohol damage because they're afraid of creating a horrible burden of guilt. But that really isn't going to help anything if the child has to struggle through school and society without knowing why he can't keep up with everyone else. So I think family physicians and the Children's Aid Society would be well advised to work harder on screening children for prenatal alcohol damage.
So what are the next steps in your work?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
So what are the next steps in your work?
Oh, the next steps in our work. That is a challenging question. We try very much to extend our literature distribution. We are active in the Niagara FASD Coalition, which is a group of agencies, mostly government agencies, in the peninsula of Niagara that are concerned about this disorder. And immediately our next step is that on April 5th, there is an all-day conference to be held in St. Catharines on that subject, and we have a speaker coming who is a person who has had these effects himself. He's a young man who has gotten past those problems, and he is a motivational speaker. And he will be speaking in the daytime, and then in the evening, our organization, specifically Alcohol Babies, has sent out an invitation to churches in the area that's called My Church Has No Idea What FASD Is Like. And we're having a panel, and that panel is made up of some educational specialists and businessmen, parents, counselors, who are going to answer questions about this disorder. So we're hoping to get some ministers to come out, some people who lead youth groups to come out and talk about this, because many of them really do not understand what the disorder consists of. So that's our immediate next step.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Great, thank you.
Of course. The importance of screening the babies who may or may not be affected by FASD cannot be overemphasized. For the fact is, these children are an incredibly precious resource. They are the future leaders. We must do everything in our power to make sure that every child has a chance to grow up happy, healthy, and safe. And it is a parent's responsibility to be protective of their child, even before they come into this world. Truth of the matter is, we don't need to create more disabilities. And FASD is very preventable with just a little common sense, just a little hope, and just a little precaution. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.